Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico and the GOP tax plan. It has been almost 2 months since the island was hit by a Category 4 hurricane. The Center for Investigative Journalism has identified 47 deaths, in addition to the 55 officially reported by the government of Puerto Rico. Joining us to discuss coverage is Julio Ricardo Varela, digital media director for Futuro Media, co-host of In the Thick, a show featuring journalists of color discussing what we're missing from the mainstream news, and a contributor to Latino USA. Hi, Julio. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Thank you. Today, we're also going to discuss the GOP's tax bill, which includes the repeal of the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate and $1.5 trillion in tax cuts that mostly benefit the wealthy and corporations. Why are the media calling this tax reform rather than tax cuts for the ultra wealthy? The bill did pass the House yesterday, and the Senate are expected to vote on it before the end of next week. Joining us is David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on again.
It's great to have you. Thank you. Well, as we always do on the Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight journalism that stood out this week. So, David Dayan, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Well, I think one of the big stories, and it hasn't gotten the attention it deserves, is called The Uncounted at the New York Times Magazine by Anand Gopal and Azmat Khan. And this was a long investigation into the counting of civilian deaths via drone strikes and civilian other civilian casualties because of the various strikes in Iraq. And it shows that they were extremely undercounted, that civilian casualties were as much as 31 times higher as what was reported, and that the military engaged in all sorts of schemes and double dealing to try to minimize the number that they would report. It's really a fine bit of journalism in a subject that we don't really pay enough attention to in this country. So I really applaud the New York Times Magazine for putting that out this week.
So this will be in this weekend's New York Times Magazine, and I heard Democracy Now! Briefly talk about this morning. David, based on your reading, how did they get this information? Because, I mean, under the Obama administration, it was difficult to get this, and I'm guessing under the Trump administration, it's even more difficult.
Yeah, I mean, they did what all good journalists should do, is they went to the source. They went to Iraq, and they went to parts of Syria and actually, you know, did the math and figured it out. Obviously there was also use of the Freedom of Information Act and sources within the government to try to, ferret that information out. But it's really quite an achievement.
Well, we should definitely invite these reporters on one of our upcoming shows. Azmat Khan and Anand Gopal, The Uncounted, will be in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. This is kind of related, David. It didn't get much attention. But this week, the House passed a $700 billion military budget, the largest military budget we've ever seen. It's not getting much attention at all.
Yeah, just be clear, they passed what is known as the National Defense Authorization Act. And that authorizes the spending, but the spending still has to be appropriated through a deal, to fund the government. So it allows spending up to that point, but it doesn't actually appropriate it yet. The thing that I've written about that's in that deal that's extremely under the radar in the defense policy bill is a thing that has come to known as the Amazon Amendment. And what that does is it enables the Defense Department to buy what they call commercial off-the-shelf products, and these are things like office supplies or furniture, from Amazon and from online marketplaces, as opposed to the way they do it now, which is they get, you know, they buy these things in bulk from contractors through long-term arrangements. And this is going to really push a good deal of federal procurement, which is, you know, billions and billions of dollars, into the pockets of Amazon. And even if third-party sellers are ultimately the ones that get the order, Amazon takes a piece of that. And so this is a way for a very large corporate concern to get even bigger by leveraging federal government procurement, one of the largest purchasers that we have in this country.
Wow. Well, we did a show about perpetual war with Gar Smith a couple of weeks ago and how much money is being spent with very little debate, or hardly any debate at all. And you can find that at yourcallradio.org. That is David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title. What about you, Julio? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
There's a couple. The first one that just happened this morning caught my attention before I even got on, is that the head of Puerto Rico's power authority, Ricardo Ramos, has resigned. Oh. If people have been following Puerto Rico regarding the whitefish contracts and things that happened around the electricity and the restoration of power, there were Senate and House hearings the same day that Jeff Sessions was speaking at the House, and Ramos was up there in front of a Senate committee and really gave very, rather weak answers about accountability in terms of why this contract was even done in the first place. As people know, it was a two-person operation that got close to $300 million, never really had a track record of power restoration, and it just felt a little bit like too much. And Ramos, I think, didn't really do a good job. Ran away from his responsibilities. He definitely looks like he's a political victim of all this, but he did resign this morning. And also on the political front, it happened yesterday amongst all the Al Franken and Roy Moore stories, the mistrial of Senator Bob Menendez in Newark, New Jersey, around corruption cases surrounding his relationship with his friend, who was actually a convicted doctor now, Dr. Solomon Melgen. One of the things that Menendez said after the trial was how the FBI couldn't believe that a Latino kid from Union City, New Jersey, became Senator of the United States, suggesting that Menendez was being targeted because he was of Cuban-American descent. I think the issues of identity and Latino politics are definitely being lost in the wayside the last couple of weeks, and especially in both Puerto Rico and both national politics. So those that definitely jumped out at me this week.
Wow. Well, we'll find those stories and post them at yourcallradio.org. That is Julio Ricardo Varela, digital media director for Fortuno Media, co-host of In the Thick, and a contributor to Latino USA. Let's dive right in and talk about Puerto Rico. And you brought up this deal with whitefish. But before we talk about that, you just translated a piece about the uncounted deaths from Hurricane Maria emerging in Puerto Rico. And the Center for Investigative Journalism has identified 47 deaths in addition to the 55 reported by the government of Puerto Rico. What did the Center for Investigative Journalism uncover?
Yeah, no, so people know the Center for Investigative Journalism is a nonprofit in Puerto Rico of independent journalists. Futuro Media Group and Latino USA, we actually commissioned them to do about 10 original stories in Spanish about stories that are happening post-recovery in Hurricane Maria, and I get to collaborate with them and edit with them and come up with story ideas, and I did the English version. So as a journalist, when I hear translate, we did much more than just translate to work with them. Like, so I just want to make sure people are clear that Futuro Media Group and Latino USA are equal partners in this reporting.
Yes, so I should have said thank you for translating, so a lot of people can read this.
Yeah, but we put it on latinousa.org, but we've been working with them right after the hurricane. So the great reporter, Omaya Sosa Pascual, who is in Puerto Rico, is one of the top health writers in Puerto Rico. And the moment that the hurricane hit around September 20th, she was starting to get calls from a lot of her sources in hospitals. And people need to understand, the power went out. Generators weren't working. And there were reports that a lot of what was happening in these hospitals Like, just imagine when the power goes out and, you know, in the 60-odd hospitals that are in Puerto Rico, that all the life support goes out. And if you don't have the generator, who knows what happened? So the government around right after September 20th for the first 2 weeks was saying that the certified death count was 16, but reports on the ground from Omaya, texts that I was getting from my fellow reporter friends in Puerto Rico, family members, contacts in the government that were telling me privately that death count was low. And it kind of hit a boiling point when President Trump came and kind of told the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, that 16 certified deaths is a good thing, when in fact it wasn't. So what the Center for the CPI, the Center for Investigative Journalism, Latino USA, Futuro Media Group, we decided to, you know, with Omaya leading the reporting, to look at other cases. And what she did was incredible journalism in terms of identifying 47 deaths where people that were related to the hurricane, whether it was a direct hit from, you know, whether it was flooding or whether something, you got hurt from something that the hurricane caused, or from health-related issues due to lack of power or other conditions in Puerto Rico. So what's on LatinoUSA.org on our front page kind of breaks down some specific cases about those deaths. And you see the stories about 9 deaths that aren't certified by the government of Puerto Rico. And it just raises questions as to why did the government of Puerto Rico, how are they looking at these deaths? Why are they not spending a lot of time acknowledging the fact that more deaths have occurred? They have gone on record, but they're very, very, they've been very, very insistent, and I would say almost stubborn, in saying it's only 55, it's only 55, it's only 55. And that anyone who raises that question, I'll leave you with before I stop for a second, because you're talking to a reporter that spent a month on this, so I feel like I have too much to share. Mm. But the Secretary of Public Security, Hector Pesquera, when I talked to him 2 weeks ago for Latino USA, when I asked him these very same questions that, you know, were hospitals not giving you the right information? Were doctors not putting it on death certificates? Why? What's happening? He questioned any journalist as having Oliver Stone theories.
Huh.
In terms of anyone who asked those questions. And there is some of an institutional arrogance here. And, you know, for anyone who's a journalist, for anyone who wants to help to seek the truth, I think holding government officials accountable and having them at least admit that other deaths that were impacted by the hurricane, whether, again, it was during the hurricane or after for lack of power or lack of access, that conversation matters. And these are real lives. These are real stories. They're heartbreaking stories that aren't being told, and we're very, very honored that we were able to publish it.
Julio, I think you bring up a really interesting and important point, because for people who are getting news about Puerto Rico, just listening to NPR, for example, or picking up a paper, I'm guessing that most of them have heard from San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz. I mean, she's almost been held up as a hero in a lot of media outlets and progressive media, but they don't really know much else about how the government of Puerto Rico has been responding to this crisis.
Right, and I think this is where it matters to be a Puerto Rican journalist. And, you know, I'm originally from Puerto Rico. I was born and raised there. I'm now based in on the East Coast. But I have been covering this island for years. And I, you know, and these local journalists from CPI, the Center for Investigative Journalism, and other journalists and other media outlets in Puerto Rico are just, you know, it goes with what we were saying at the top of the show. To find out what's really going on, you need to be there. You need to understand. You need to go outside the metro area. And a lot of, you know, in the case of the San Juan mayor, she's only one voice, right? And I think the U.S. media sometimes just gravitates to one or two voices when, in fact, there are serious questions from the administration of Governor Rosselló regarding death counts, regarding reports of power. You know, one of the things that a lot of people missed, and I actually wrote about this for Latino USA 3 weeks ago, is that the government of Puerto Rico was telling people that, you know, oh, 35% of people have power, 40% of people have power. It's just not true. What it is, it's power generation. And that's much different. And they've been doing that. But the problem is, by saying that and letting journalists, you know, journalists don't challenge it, the only reason I was able to look at that is that because I follow the local news, I read Spanish, I have connections in the government. And it's really an important point, because The strategy by the Puerto Rican government is to focus on bigger structures that need power. So the logic makes sense in the sense it's like, let's power up hospitals. Well, they're going to take up more power. So it doesn't mean that when you have 45% power generation, that 45% of the country, 45% of residents have power. That number is much lower. And the government of Puerto Rico, I got the government of Puerto Rico to go on record to tell the world, to tell people, at least in the United States, that they don't know how many people have power on the island. And if you go to San Juan, and if you go to places where the metro area, there are still places in San Juan where there has not been power for 2 months. So in that case, the mayor of San Juan is right. But at the same time, journalists that are covering Puerto Rico had to almost be reminded, and I'm talking about English language journalists that kind of dive into Puerto Rico and say, this is the story of the week. That's a big point. And so knowing the politics, knowing the society, knowing the culture, knowing how the news gets disseminated on the island, you either have it in your DNA as a journalist or you don't. And being a Puerto Rican journalist, I'm very proud of the fact that I'm able to communicate to the mainland certain points that are being overlooked in other coverage.
Yes, it's so important. In fact, we've done one or two shows about Puerto Rico. I think we've even dropped the ball on this. David, what are your thoughts? I mean, from Al Jazeera Plus across the board, most of the coverage has been on Mayor Cruz because she's so outspoken. She's slamming Trump on a regular basis. And I'm guessing a lot of people really don't know what's happening in Puerto Rico.
Well, I also think it's because she's the mayor of San Juan. And that's the biggest city. That's the city that, your airlifted traveling journalists have access to. They don't necessarily, move outside the major metropolitan area. And so that becomes, kind of obvious, I think, to me. But, yes, there is obviously a lot going on under the surface. This is the big picture is that we're more than 2 months out from this situation, and as your other colleague was saying, whether you believe it's 30% or whether you believe that if you're talking about actual residents with power, it's something like 20 or 15 or 10%. The fact that it's not 100%, 2 months. This is not something we would accept in Iowa. This is not something we would accept in Wyoming. This is not something we would accept in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. This is something that is that we're accepting in an American commonwealth full of 3.5 million American citizens, and it's the fact that this is even moved away from the headlines is really a real problem, a testament to the colonial nature of Puerto Rico, and how we have a differing set of standards for the people that live in the midst of that tragedy than we would for if this took place in any American city.
Julio, to give a name to some of the people who died in this piece that you collaborated with, the Center for Investigative Journalism, the death of Teodoro Colon, the death of Maria Melendez Aponte, Salvador mm-hmm. Rosa Montañez. I mean, the list goes on. And you all report that the investigation shows that the government has re-victimized the relatives of people who have died due to the circumstances mm-hmm. linked to the emergency, forcing them to comply with bureaucratic requirements at a time when the government failed to comply with its obligations. Some of these victims' family members had to spend days with the corpse of their loved ones decomposing
right.
in a home because the police or prosecutors never arrived to remove the body.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's what it is. If you understand one thing, imagine an island with no communication. And, people die. It's not like people stop dying. And that's the big question here. The big question is, there's a serious question about what constitutes a natural death in all this. And there were reports that 911 cremations happened, and they were all recorded as natural death. And it's because that's what the certificate said, and that's what the hospital said. But, you know, these nine cases that we put in a map raise questions about when you have a society that has no power, no communication, and that everything you do online becomes manual and you don't have access, it just raises the issue that the death count could be higher. And for example, between, you know, the government of Puerto Rico reported that in September of this year, the number of daily average deaths after Maria increased by 34, 35 dead people per day on average. But they will not attribute that to the hurricane, because it's almost like passing the buck. It's all, let's blame the doctors, let's blame the hospitals, let's blame the family members for not reporting it correctly. When the roads are closed and you can't call people, you can't get to a funeral home, you can't get to the town hall. There's a story of a son-in-law who had to walk 4 hours to report that his father-in-law was dead.
Wow.
It was in his room. So, you know, the normalcy of it, it just goes away. And there's this question of, like, why did the government of Puerto Rico not conduct science, you know, look at this more scientifically? Why are they being so stubborn? And there's no other word to describe it, to say it's only 55. And there's this sense on the island, it's like, at least just admit it. Admit that there are more deaths. Admit that, you know, it wasn't done well. No one's going to resign over this, but I think people want more honesty. And to the point about the power and where we are stand every 2 months, I will add that, you know, if you go back to the hearings this week in Congress, I will also add that Texas and Florida were never put under this economic scrutiny to ask for money for federal aid. You know, the fact that it's two months, and not only is the power an issue, but that the fact that the only money that the government of Puerto Rico has gotten is a $5 billion loan,
yep,
when in fact the government of Puerto Rico asked for $92 billion in damage assessment, and they're going through congressional hearings, and people are like, I don't know, maybe we'll do this, maybe we'll not, how do we know? You want to talk about the colonizer lecturing the colonized and their American citizens? That's what happened in D.C. this week. And that any American listening to this should realize that colonialization is deep into the cause of how the United States views Puerto Rico. And it didn't happen in Texas and Florida. Texas and Florida got their money in 9 days. We're talking 2 months now. And I don't see the money coming to Puerto Rico. It's not going to happen in December. Congress is going to be out. We're going to be talking like people are still going to be without power for 6 months, even a year, and we're not going to get enough money. Puerto Rico's not going to get the money. It's
yeah,
ridiculous.
I just want to put a finer point on one of the things that was just said regarding this loan. So this is completely outrageous. That bill had no dedicated funding for Puerto Rico, except
right.
for this loan to finance ongoing operations. And at the same time, in the same bill, the National Flood Insurance Program was given a bailout of $20 billion. And that particular bailout affects people on the mainland, largely because there wasn't a lot of flood insurance payments in Puerto Rico, in places like Texas and Florida. So we bailed out and eliminated the debts of wealthy people who live by the ocean in Texas and in other parts of the country, and we put this loan together for a colony, effectively, that already is $73 billion in debt. That's a loan that has to be repaid, that goes on to the existing debt that the island of Puerto Rico has, and it only will worsen the finances in the long term of the country. And this is all because the reason they needed money to finance ongoing operations is that they had this crushing storm that made it impossible to collect taxes. So
right.
that was the major reason why you needed this money, and instead of giving it as an emergency grant, it was given as a loan. And we would not stand for that if it was being done on the mainland of the United States. It's outrageous.
Well, yeah. we're going to have to spend an entire hour on this, Julio.
We're
more than happy to come back anytime. I love to talk about where I come from.
No, exactly. And I appreciate all the work you've done. In fact, Latino USA has an hour episode called Surviving the Storm, and it's about how mm-hmm. the lack of electricity has been a matter of death for many residents, and you profile a number of people in Puerto Rico. So we'll definitely have you back. Julio Ricardo Varela is Digital Media Director for Futuro Media, co-host of In the Thick, and a contributor to Latino USA. Julio, thank you so much for your reporting. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up after the break, we will talk about coverage of the GOP's tax bill with David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept. We'll also be joined by Jesse Drucker. He reports on taxes for The New York Times. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email, yourcall@kalw.org, or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A, more on Zimbabwe and Mugabe, as well as voting in Australia, and details about the climate change conference in Germany. 1A heading your way at 11 here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it's our media roundtable, and now we are going to talk about coverage of the GOP tax bill. It includes the repeal of the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate and $1.5 trillion in tax cuts that mostly benefit the ultra-wealthy and multinationals. Today, we're joined by David Dayan, contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. David wrote a piece for The New Republic called The Biggest Trojan Horse in the Republican Tax Plan. And now I would like to welcome Jesse Drucker to the show. Jesse covers taxes and other business topics for The New York Times. And he wrote a piece with Simon Bowers called After a Tax Crackdown, Apple Found a New Shelter for Its Profits. He also has a piece called Trump Could Save More Than $1 Billion, that's billion with a B, under his new tax plan. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to the show. Hi, do we have Jesse? All right, we will get Jesse in just a minute. David, let's dive in here and talk about what we're facing. You know, I feel like I really wish the media would do a better job of providing a context, looking at where we're at right now. So a couple headlines that stood out for me, Jared Bernstein in the Washington Post had a piece, Republican tax plan will lead to more offshoring of jobs and a larger trade deficit. The Guardian and many other outlets reported that Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Warren Buffett now have more wealth than half of the United States, 160 million people. And then the Washington Post has another story. The fastest growing jobs in the United States pays about $22,000 a year. So the jobs that are growing, we keep hearing about all of these jobs being created. The majority of these jobs pay $22,000 a year. What else do you think we need to put in context before we dive in and talk about this tax bill?
I guess the core question is, what problem are you trying to solve? You just put out that we have this sort of economy that the gains are being enjoyed by the wealthy. Certainly, corporations do not lack for investment capital, and that's a pretty key one, because if you think about this bill, the largest and most lasting and permanent part of it is a corporate tax cut from 35% to 20%. And the idea, the core idea behind the bill, is that this will jumpstart the economy. That this, if you're giving back more of these tax dollars to these corporations, they will use them to invest in their businesses, create jobs, and that will cycle through the economy. I mean, that's the core assumption here.
Right.
That real working people will see that money that is being relieved of corporations to pay, and it's just not true. I mean, the core assumption is based on this falsehood that is at odds with all the experience we know. First of all, it's the context of where we are today, that corporations have plenty of money if they wanted to invest. They don't make investment decisions based on where their tax rate is. They make investment decisions based on whether they think that money that they invest will actually get a return for them. And there was an extremely telling moment this week where Gary Cohn, who's the National Economic Council head, top economic advisor to President Trump, was at a meeting of CEOs. It was a roundtable discussion of CEOs, and he said, everybody out there who's going to invest the money they get back from this tax cut, in jobs and businesses, please raise your hand. And maybe two CEOs raised their hand. And Gary Cohn audibly says, why aren't your other hands up? And the reason their other hands aren't up is that we know where this money is going to go. It's going to go into dividends to pay out the money to shareholders. It's going to go into executive compensation, and it's going to go into what are called stock buybacks, where the corporation buys back stocks in a ploy to raise the stock price, again, leaking money out to shareholders. And that's where we can expect all of this funding to go. Mm. If you give corporations a cut on their taxes, it's going to flow to the very top. And once you know that, once you have that core assumption in place, that corporations could do all the investment they wanted to right now and they're not, and that the experience of these kinds of corporate tax cuts is that it goes back into the hands of the 1%, it just blows up the entire rationale for this overhaul.
David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept, and I think we now have Jesse Drucker with us. He's a reporter with The New York Times. Are you there, Jesse?
I am.
Hi, thank you. Sorry about that technical glitch.
No problem.
So we've been talking a little bit about putting these tax cuts in context before we dive in and talk about what's in these two bills. We were just talking about how corporate profits are off the charts. We're seeing massive CEO pay. The fastest growing jobs in the country pay about $22,000 a year. What else would you add to the context before we talk about the details of these tax bills?
Well, I think one of the most significant things on the corporate side is that U.S. companies have basically stockpiled over $2.5 trillion in their offshore subsidiaries, basically to avoid paying U.S. income tax. And a number of the provisions in the proposed legislation would essentially reward that behavior. I mean, in other words, you have companies like Apple and Google and Pfizer, et cetera, that have pushed hundreds of billions of dollars of profits into subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands and Ireland and Bermuda, et cetera. And the corporate portions of the proposed legislation would not only cut the overall corporate income tax from 35% to 20%, but would actually introduce new incentives for them to push even more profits into subsidiaries like this in the future and lower their tax bills.
How do you think the media are reporting on the corporate tax myth? And that's what the Institute of Taxation and Economic Policy call it. So when you have a Republican going on PBS NewsHour, NPR, saying that we've got the highest corporate tax rates in the world and that's why we're offshoring jobs. But if you look at the data, according to the ITEP, of the 258 profitable Fortune 500 companies, 18 paid zero in taxes over 8 years, 100 paid zero or less in at least 1 year, 24 zeroed out their taxes in at least 4 of the 8 years. I mean, it just goes on and on. So, Jesse, what are your thoughts about how the media are reporting on the claims that we're hearing by mostly Republicans?
I'm not really sure. you know, one thing is I can't really speak to how accurate those numbers are. I mean, they do actually, frankly, sound a little off to me. Because it's a little difficult to know with some of the big companies precisely what they're paying in income taxes. We know what they report for financial accounting purposes, but I'm not sure where they're getting those data on some of these companies truly reporting zero corporate income taxes. I don't really know. I mean, I think that there is probably a pretty good understanding that U.S. companies don't pay taxes at a rate of anything close to 35%. I mean, I think that probably, I mean, you actually just sort of said something a second ago that I think actually might sort of misstate one of the issues here. I mean, companies are not moving jobs into Bermuda and the Cayman Islands, right? The U.S. corporate income tax rate and the system, whatever its drawbacks may be in the minds of corporate tax directors, U.S. companies are not moving jobs into the jurisdictions where they are moving profits, right? In other words, just to back up for a second, you know, the critics of the corporate tax system and the corporate tax rate will compare us to, will look at the rate here and say, look, this is the highest in the world. And on a statutory basis, that is accurate. On an effective basis, like what the companies are actually paying, it's actually very comparable to other Western and other modern industrialized countries. But the companies are not moving jobs into the UK, where the tax rate, I guess, is now around 20 or 21%. They're not moving jobs anymore, really, into Ireland, where the tax rate is 12.5%. What they're doing is they are moving profits into these offshore jurisdictions like Cayman and Bermuda, where there is no corporate income tax at all. And I think that there is a kind of very popular misconception that the system is forcing companies to move jobs overseas. And that is not what is happening. That is not what we see. We see them moving trillions of dollars of profits overseas into places where they don't have any employees, right? Google and Apple do not have employees in Bermuda and the island of Jersey. What they have there is a disproportionate amount of their profit, which helps them avoid U.S. income tax. And I think that is probably something that is not well understood both by politicians and by the media.
Right. Can I quick respond to that?
David.
So that's absolutely true, and it's important to understand in the context of what the Republican tax bill would do and what critics claim it would be the effect on jobs. So the way that you have profits in these companies without having employees there is, for example, through their intellectual property. So Apple has a patent for maybe a certain type of item that goes into their computers, and they have the patents registered in the island of Jersey. And that's the profits are derived from that patent, and that's how they store those profits sort of there. What this tax bill would do is say that we're only going to tax you on the profits that you earn in the United States. The profits you earn anywhere else in the world, the United States is not going to tax you on them. And there is a safeguard that they say that they've put in for this kind of thing around intellectual property, these intangible, as they call it, assets in other countries. If you have a certain number of those, they are going to take a minimum tax from those companies. And what critics say this will have the effect of is companies will say, well, if we have just the intangible, we try to do this dodge where we put our patents in the Isle of Jersey, they're going to tax us. But if we put our entire manufacturing operation and combine that with the patents and put it in another country, the U.S. isn't going to tax us. So the idea that critics say is that this is going to incentivize a move of these tangible assets overseas, which we've already seen a lot of course, but it would just accelerate that process, and you would actually see the jobs, whether it was factory jobs or even white-collar jobs, move to these other countries.
David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept, and Jesse Drucker is a reporter covering taxes with The New York Times. And if you have any questions or comments about how taxes has been covered in the press, it's getting nonstop coverage. The House bill just passed yesterday, 227 to 205. 13 Republicans voted against it. 0 Democrats voted for it. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And those numbers that I put out earlier came from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. I just wanted to make sure to repeat that. Jesse, you wrote a piece as part of the Paradise Papers. We've been covering that pretty regularly about how Apple found a new shelter for its profits. And we've been reporting on this over the past couple of weeks. You report that Apple has accumulated more than $128 billion in profits offshore and probably much more that is untaxed by the U.S. and hardly touched by any other country. Nearly all of that was made over the past decade. How would this bill affect a company like Apple?
So that's a really good question. Basically, the way the U.S. system works for multinational companies is that, in theory, companies are supposed to pay 35% corporate income tax on their worldwide earnings. But the big caveat is that you only pay that tax currently on the profits that you say are earned in the U.S. Anything that's earned outside the U.S., you get an indefinite deferral on as long as those profits stay outside the U.S. And so the result is that companies have a huge incentive to push as much profit as possible outside of the U.S. and into as low tax the jurisdiction as possible. The downside that the companies have, like Apple, for instance, is they've got, more, I think it's something like $250 billion in cash overseas. And the problem they have is, on the one hand, they have been able to avoid U.S. tax on those earnings. But the problem is that they're somewhat restricted in what they can use the cash for. Now, in theory, since they say the profits were earned overseas, then their needs for the cash would be overseas, right? But the dilemma that the companies find themselves in is that since the profits weren't really earned overseas in large part, right? It's kind of a gimmick for tax purposes. In fact, they do want the cash here in the U.S., whether it's to buy back stock or to pay dividends or to do actual real-world investments here in the U.S. And so the companies have a little bit of a dilemma, which is that they are able to manage their tax rates low by pushing profits overseas, but then it restricts their use of the cash once it's offshore. What the bill's proposed to do is to provide, in some ways, it's a little bit of a carrot and a stick, but I think it's mostly a carrot for the companies, which is they're saying, okay, Google, Cisco, Apple, you've been paying taxes on the earnings that you've claimed to be earned offshore at rates of 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6%. Now what's going to happen is you're going to have to pay 10% on those earnings. And so the result is that they're probably going to pay, if this became law, they would probably pay a little bit more in income tax on the offshore earnings. But in exchange for paying a little bit more, they would have complete freedom to do with the cash that's getting thrown off by those profits, just complete freedom to do whatever they want. So currently the situation is, a given multinational might be paying tax at a rate of 5% on the profits they've moved into Bermuda or the Cayman or Ireland or Luxembourg, and the cash is kind of trapped. If the bills became law, they would pay taxes at a rate of 10%, and the cash they'd have complete freedom to do whatever they want. So in a situation like Apple, you can sort of see how the legislation would both have a little bit of a drawback for them, but ultimately would be kind of hugely liberating for companies with tax arrangements like theirs.
And in the Senate bill, the Republicans decided to make the tax cuts for businesses permanent. Cuts for individuals would expire. And if we have time, we can talk about that. Jesse, major differences between the House and Senate bill, specifically on corporate taxes?
So there are some differences, like in the number that I just gave you for the 10%. I believe that in the Senate bill that it's not 10, that it's 12.5, but I could be getting that wrong. There are some sort of minor differences or some extremely technical differences in how you calculated this. But sort of conceptually, they are sort of the same in both offering a tax holiday and profits that are already offshore and in how they would treat future profits overseas for these companies.
David Dayan, we've been here
before. And I'm sorry, they both have the same rate offer, you know, they would both cut the rate to 20%.
David Dayan, we have been here before with the George W. Bush tax cuts, and we often hear about so-called trickle-down economics. Do you think the media are doing a good enough job of looking at what has happened in the past when we have seen these kinds of tax cuts for corporations and what the end result was?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is the Republican strategy, which I guess I would just call the lightning round, has frustrated attempts to take a very complicated subject like taxes and really lay it out for the public in a digestible way. I mean, we got the release of this bill 2 weeks ago, I believe, and it's already passed the House, and it's passed the key committee in the Senate. Now, those two bills are wildly different. There's going to be a period where even if the week after Thanksgiving, which is the target date, even if the Senate bill passes then, there's some question whether it will. There are already some Republican senators that are wavering. You know, there's going to be a period where they're going to have to reconcile those two bills, and there's some major differences, the biggest being the individual mandate repeal, the second biggest being the individual tax cuts, the individual rates expiring to comply with Senate rules. But, you know, we've only had a couple weeks, and so it's not surprising to me that it's been hard to really lay out the consequences of, you know, these very long and very complicated subjects. So the Republicans are kind of learning from the health care debate that if you stick something out there, eventually the public and the media will get it. So they're trying to just sort of do a lightning round and make sure that no one has including their own members, have a great understanding of what it is they're signing on to.
Well, what have past tax cuts done in terms of job creation and salaries? We're talking about average people here. I mean, I mentioned this.
Oh, absolutely.
The new jobs that are being created are paying about $22,000 a year. They're mostly home health care workers. But what does the data tell us about
right.
what past cuts have done?
I mean, what you'll hear from Republicans is that tax cuts kickstart the economy. What you see in the data is that after the 1993 budget that raised taxes signed by President Clinton, the economy ended up doing quite well. After the 2001 and 2003 Bush tax cuts, the economy just sort of muddled through, and it was really an asset bubble that propped it up. After President Obama in 2011, after the fiscal cliff negotiations, or maybe that was 2013, after the top rate ended up going back up a little bit, that didn't have a major impact on the economy. So the evidence is really quite mixed as to this axiomatic idea from Republicans that tax cuts are always and forever the solution to all these problems within the economy. And I think if you want to pinpoint it for corporate taxes, in 2004, President Bush signed this thing, some call a tax holiday or a tax amnesty. It allowed all this money that was trapped overseas to be brought back at a very nominal rate, well below the 35% corporate tax rate. So corporations could voluntarily bring this money back to the United States, repatriate it at a low rate. I don't remember the exact rate. Maybe it was 8%, 10%, something like that. And this was looked at. What was done with that money? What did these corporations do who brought back this money in corporate taxes? And they didn't use it for investment. This was in a Senate subcommittee on permanent investigations report. They didn't use it for investment. They didn't use it to create jobs. In fact, the net of the largest corporations who brought back money from overseas is they cut jobs. And what they did do with it is they put it into dividends, they put it into stock buybacks, and they put it into executive compensation. So, and this is true to the extent that we saw there was an interview with President Clinton where he said that George W. Bush confided in him that these CEOs lied to him, that they said they were going to put this money into investment, and they didn't. And he said he'd never do something like that again. But here we are 13 years later, and we're about to go through it all over again.
Jesse, you and your colleague Nadia Popovich have a piece called Trump Could Save More Than $1 Billion Under His New Tax Plan. And this is based on the estimate of Trump's net worth, calculated by Bloomberg's Billionaire Index to be about $2.86 billion. And then you looked at the 2005 return, the most recent available publicly return, released by David K. Johnston of DCReport.org. Talk about why you decided to take this angle, and what did you find?
Well, what we found, you know, there are essentially three major tax cuts for very wealthy individuals like President Trump. One, there is the repeal. There is either the new phase-in or potentially outright repeal of the estate tax, which in his case, that's what provides the bulk of that $1 billion benefit that we calculated in that story. Is we looked at his estimated net worth, take away the estate tax, and then that's this nearly $1 billion benefit for him. The other two big benefits for people at his level of net worth, at his level of wealth and income, are a repeal of the alternative minimum tax, and then what is probably kind of the most revolutionary part of the entire tax package, which is this new lower rate for what's called pass-through income. In other words, right now, if you're a partner in a partnership, there's no such thing as a corporate-level tax for a partnership. The income all flows through the individual partners, and they pay taxes at whatever rate bracket they're in. This package creates this concept that's never existed before, which is basically a whole new bucket of income, which is that simply by virtue of realizing your income through a pass-through entity like a partnership, there would be a new lower rate. Now, that there actually is a pretty significant difference in those rates in the Senate and the House bills. I think in the House bill, it's 25%, and in the Senate bill, I think it's closer to 32%. But that outside of the estate tax repeal, that would be the biggest benefit to both President Trump and potentially to other people like Steve Mnuchin, who I think historically have realized lots of income through partnerships, that there's essentially this new low rate in the case of the House bill, potentially 15 percentage points than what current law permits. And so that's a benefit that he wouldn't just realize, that President Trump wouldn't just realize, but lots of other people at that level of income. I mean, in a way, one of the interesting things about the package is that it's not really a package aimed at millionaires. It's a package aimed at multimillionaires and billionaires, because there's no significant reduction in the top rate. For people who are making hundreds of thousands of dollars, who are wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, would not benefit by and large from the significant provisions in the legislation or in the proposed legislation. It is people who are generally going to be realizing income in the millions or hundreds of millions or potentially billions of dollars over their lifetimes through things like partnerships or receiving capital gains, who have the potential to leave massive amounts of wealth in their estate to their heirs. Those are the people who are really going to benefit from this package if it becomes law.
And just quickly, Jesse, when is the Senate going to vote on this?
I'm actually not sure of what the date is on that right now.
I believe I can help you out there. It's supposed to be the week after Thanksgiving. So next week, Congress is out of session. And the week after that, theoretically, they're supposed to be on the floor. But as I said, certain Senate Republicans have already expressed misgivings, particularly over the health care part of the bill that had to be sort of thrown in to comply with certain deficit reduction rules within the Senate.
Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this. David Dayan is contributor to The Intercept and author of Chain of Title. And Jesse Drucker is a reporter covering taxes with The New York Times. David and Jesse, thank you for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.